The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eade, Judge Bond, Judge Riley, the Honorable Kayala C. Eade presiding.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals Zoom calendar this morning. We have three oral arguments set on our calendar this morning. It's May 22nd, 2025. The first case on our calendar is A250016, Charles Ward et al. Appellants versus Ward Family Inc. et al. Respondents. Before we begin, a couple of housekeeping matters. This is being recorded. As you heard me mention a few moments ago, there will be an official oral argument recording posted on our website, usually in about 24 hours. That's the only recording that's to be made of this proceeding. Counsel for the appellants will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin your argument, please state your name and the party you are representing. And with that, Ms. Jewell, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Just a few highlights to point out, as I know the time goes by so fast on these hearings. I really want to hone in for the court the opportunity that you have today with this case.
Oh, and just don't forget to state your name and who you
Yes.
represent for the record.
Sorry about that. Sarah Jewell, Jewell, on behalf of the plaintiffs, Charles Ward et al. And
Right, go
now,
ahead.
court, thank you. Really wanting to highlight the opportunity that this panel, this court has today to provide some clarification, really to all members of family-owned corporations or closely held corporations under the corporate statute 302A.751. And what I'd like to point out, really, before the time runs down too quickly, is subdivision 3A of that statute provides that when determining equitable relief, I'm paraphrasing here, whether dissolution or buyout, the court shall take into consideration the duty which all shareholders in closely held corporations owe to one another to act in honest, fair, and reasonable manner. I won't cite everything in there, but I'm just highlighting again and paraphrasing. The biggest thing is the reasonable expectations of all shareholders as they exist at the inception of the corporation and as they develop over the course of the shareholders' relationship with the corporation and with each other. What we have here is a case that I feel is very similar to the Lund versus Lund case, which is, this court's case from 2019. It's cited in our brief, 924 Northwest 2nd, 274. Review was denied by the Supreme Court on March 27th of 2019. The biggest distinguishment in that is that that case dealt with, first of all, the Minnesota Trust Act. So there's been some further clarifications for you in its connection to that. That does not apply to this case because we do not have a trust involved at all. But the second point I want to make about the big legal difference between the Lund case and this case is that in the Lund case, the parties had at the inception of that corporation prepared and signed and entered into shareholders' agreements. And so there was knowledge that the court had, and they were able to utilize that knowledge of what the party's reasonable expectations were from the inception based on those documents that had already been, drafted, signed, and agreed to with various terms and provisions of how that would work. As the court is well aware, a closely held corporation, especially a family-owned business, it's very difficult to get out of if a party does not want to any longer stay in it. It can be fraught with issues because of the family dynamics, the interrelationships between, siblings and things like that. Very similar to the Lund case. In fact, the beginning of the court's decision in the Lund versus Lund case starts out with almost the exact same theme as the respondent's brief in this particular case. And I'm quoting now from the very beginning of that case where it states, quote, "This appeal arises from decades-long friction among the Lund siblings, the grandchildren of grocery chain founder Russell T. Lund Sr., over one sibling's desire to divest her various trusts, and et cetera, end quote. But the point there I want to make is that the respondents in this case would like to draw your attention to a couple of prior litigation matters that have involved these same siblings and the same parties to the current case in a way to distract you from the current issues that are under 302A.751. But please do not allow respondents to distract you with that, because Judge Mahler, even though we are appealing from the ultimate decision Judge Mahler made on this particular case, she did have the opportunity to dismiss these claims that we brought under 302A.751, because earlier in the litigation, you'll see from the, I think it's like a 38-page record here under MCRO that I printed off this morning, that the respondents did in fact attempt to make an early motion to dismiss. And one of their legal theories in that was that they wanted the court to dismiss this current case based on res judicata or claim preclusion, you know, that these claims have been heard already, that all this stuff has been litigated previously. But the Judge Mahler was not persuaded by that, and so the case went forward. We are really challenging the final handling of this in a later motion, a couple of later motions. One is our discovery motion to compel. We deposed Molly Thompson, who was produced to us by respondents as the corporate designee under a 30.02 deposition, where we requested a corporate designee to come forth and provide, you know, answers to questions, including documents on behalf of the corporation. That was on July 6th, 2023. Oh.
Yep. Ms. Jewell, I'm going to interrupt you because I want to make sure I understand.
Sure.
My understanding is that Judge Mahler denied the motion to dismiss, and then you went forward. You wanted to have the family corporation, WFI, dissolved, and the respondents wanted, they asked for a buyout. And so that's, as I understand it, the judge went with a buyout and then went to trial so that she could determine the fair price of the shares for the buyout. Do I have that right?
It is correct in part, in that we did request initially a dissolution, but it was an alternative. We obviously knew that was not going to be likely to be granted. So in our complaint, we did request any equitable relief. And we did also request that our clients be allowed to perform a buyout and produce, you know, evidence.
So the trial went on, and as I understand it, you presented two experts about the price of the shares, and respondents presented two experts. And the judge found three of the experts, both of the respondents' experts and one of yours, not very helpful, but then went with the analysis that I think, is it Gadara, Pete Gadara had testified to?
She did not actually appreciate Mr. Gadara's viewpoint.
Oh, Strakata, excuse me.
One, yes.
Okay. And so it was your own expert who the judge found credible, who said that factoring in everything, including the lease on the real estate, that the shares were worth a little over a dollar a share.
Right. Yes. And we are not disputing what our expert's testimony was in the case at all. What we're stating is that procedurally, and I guess just due process wise, we were not able to obtain the information from respondents pursuant to our motion to compel to find out why in 2012, which is the same year that this lease, what sort of a blanket lease was put on the entire 1,206 acres of property, why was there a appraisal done of the land by one of the controlling shareholders who's one of the board members of WFI?
So, but as I understand it, the 2014 lawsuit, the issue was whether or not that lease was in the WFI's best interest, right?
But I was not involved in that matter, but that's my understanding. It was a shareholder derivative action, as I believe the way that it ended up kind of playing out. And so there was a special litigation committee. But
in 2018, there was another lawsuit to declare the lease invalid.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, that is correct. Yep.
And then there's some other, those are from the two precedential opinions, but there are some other opinions that our court has decided, right? Starting this case.
I think those are the only two that I'm aware of. The 2018, well, I think that 2014 case concluded roughly in 2018. Again, I wasn't the attorney of record on that matter. I believe the second one concluded, upon appeal in 2021, if I recall correctly. I'm sorry, I don't have those case files in front of me today.
So then
But
I
yeah.
want to turn to your second issue, which has to do with evidentiary rulings. And you did not file a motion for a new trial.
No, Your Honor, we wanted to bring an appeal, of all the issues that were going to be presented because we do feel like this is a case of first impression with respect
You
to the fact.
are familiar with our case law, and that says matters such as trial procedure, evidentiary rulings are subject to appellate review only if there's been a motion for a new trial in which such matters have been assigned as error.
Yes,
And
we
so, my
are.
question to you is why, how do we even consider your arguments with regard to the second section of your brief when you didn't file a motion for a new trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe we did address this in our reply brief, which I will get into here. I think we argued in our reply that there is an exception and that the court can look at this, even though we did not seek to obtain a new trial. And so we would just rest on our arguments that were made and presented. I understand the procedural posture is probably a little bit different with this matter. But again, when there is such a strong evidence and showing of bias, we feel like this court does need to correct that. And that's
Well, can we keep the bias issues separate for a moment? Maybe you can get into that in a minute, but let's assume that we can review the evidentiary issues you raised. Why isn't the error that you've alleged or the abuse of discretion that you've alleged with regard to the court's evidentiary rulings, why isn't that harmless? What is the prejudice, I guess, in other words, for each type? Can you articulate what the prejudice was to your case?
Yes. And so one of the biggest factors that we found was prejudicial through the matter of the trial was that the court, sua sponte, requested to question one of the respondent's witnesses while I had called him on the stand to testify. And in doing so, just pretty openly and clearly requested what the defendant at that time, now respondent's, opinion would be of what she should do with this entire matter and what she should do with this case and with how the outcome of the shares would go. And of course, because he's a named one of the named defendants respondents, he articulated very clearly that he would like the judge to rule in favor of the defendant's respondents, which is exactly what she did. And when I requested to, once the court rested with the line of questioning, I requested to then have some, follow-up questions to that. I was denied that opportunity to ask follow-up questions based on the responses that were given. And that goes to the intent under 302A.751 because the defendant that was being questioned in this example I'm giving you, and I apologize for not mentioning this sooner, was Richard Ward, who is the one who is the father of all these siblings that have been, unfortunately, litigating and disputing these matters over, decades, just like the Lund matter. And, in doing that, it really was prejudicial that I was not allowed to then ask follow-up questions. I've seen other judges,
Wait, so let's drill down on that a sec because your time's running out. So let's assume we're with you up until that point. What's the offer of proof as to what he would have said that would have resulted in a different outcome had you been able to question him?
Yeah, if I had been able to question him, I would have asked him questions about, the WFI corporate designee in this case did admit under oath in the deposition that was done that a 2012 appraisal had been done paid for personally by that shareholder who's a member of the board. I would have wanted to ask him, why was that done and why was it not provided in the other two cases? Why was it not disclosed in this case? Was there something else going on? Why was the reason that, one of the shareholders who did come down and testify very briefly, Maggie Motel, why did she give a forever proxy to
But
Molly?
so those are the questions you would have asked. What's the evidence that you expect would have come in that would have changed the outcome of the trial?
Well, if Richard Ward would have been able to answer that, I mean, this is getting a bit speculative, in nature, but
That's and I to Judge Eads' earlier question, was there an offer of proof? What is there in the record?
well, Your Honor, I was denied the opportunity to answer to even ask questions when I
Well,
did.
you didn't ask to make an offer of proof when I read the transcript. And
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that judges, when someone says, I want to make an offer of proof, and this is all speculation, but my experience is that they say, go ahead, make your record. Because I didn't see that you made or asked to make offers of proof.
In that situation, I did not, Your Honor. I felt that the court was shutting me down on that and was making her determination at that time that no other questions would be allowed. We had called that person as our witness, and so we did get to question him, a bit. But then at the end, after the court sua sponte did their questioning, we were not allowed to do follow-up questions after that. And so it just ended at that point. And we were
Thank
running
you.
out for the trial as well.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal unless there's any other questions at this time, and not seeing any, we will turn to respondent. And if you wouldn't mind muting yourself, Ms. Jewell, while respondent. Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Wills. I've got the respondents in this case, and the respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the district court in all the decisions that it made. I think it's important at the outset of this appeal to talk about what is not being appealed as much as what is being appealed. This case started with the appellant suing the respondents and asserting a variety of claims. All of those claims were dismissed by the district court before we ever got to trial. The appellants have not appealed that. That's not part of their statement of the case. It's not part of their discussion in their principal brief. They have not appealed the dismissal of all their claims. Before the case went to trial, we filed a motion asking that the court order a buyout. And Judge Mahler granted that motion and scheduled the matter for a trial to discuss which groups of shareholders should be bought out and what the price of those shares should be. And again, the appellants in this case, in their statement of the case and in their principal brief, do not argue that Judge Mahler erred in granting that request for a buyout. The only complaint that they make in the statement of the case and in their principal brief in the argument section relates specifically to what occurred during the course of that trial. So this court isn't being asked to decide, did Judge Mahler make the right decisions when she decided to dismiss all their claims? Did she make the right decision in deciding to order, a buyout, that was the appropriate equitable remedy to try and resolve this situation? The only question is, did she commit errors during the course of the trial? And I think the only proper error that appellants have raised that is before this court is Judge Mahler's ultimate conclusion on the value of appellant shares in WFI. And so I'll start there. Judge Mahler determined that the value of each share in WFI was $1.05. Now, in her decision, she labels that as a conclusion of law, but I think it's pretty clear that it's actually a factual finding. We had eight witnesses who testified at trial and were asked questions about what the value of the shares in WFI were. And obviously, if that's a conclusion of law, then none of those witnesses would have been allowed to offer that testimony. And the difference between the two is obviously very important for purposes of determining what the standard of review is. As a factual finding, her determination, Judge Mahler's decision that each share in WFI is worth $1.05, is reviewed for clear error. That's a very deferential standard. This court doesn't have to agree with the conclusion that Judge Mahler came to.
Oh, wait,
Judge
look, can
Eden.
I ask you a second there? So one of the main arguments we heard today from the appellants is that is the idea that the district court relied too much on Richard's testimony in deciding the value of the shares. Along the lines of what you're just arguing, why isn't that a valid basis for us to determine that there was clear error if we agree with you that this was a finding of fact based on what you just said?
Yeah, so for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. Number one, Judge. So number one, there was never any motion for a new trial made. Is a evidentiary issue that occurred during the course of the trial. A new trial motion was mandatory for that to get raised
Not
here as
even as
part
an
of the appeal.
evidentiary issue, just as an issue of placing too much emphasis on what Richard testified to and deciding what the value of the shares
Yeah,
were.
I. And Your Honor, I think if you look at at Judge Mahler's decision from November 7, 2024, there are numerous things that she cites in the course of that discussion as to why she made the determination that the respondents would be the ones in this case to ultimately buy out the appellants. Mr. Ward, in his testimony, Richard Ward, did not offer any opinion as to what the value of the shares actually was. The only thing that he offered was, here's who I think should ultimately buy out, this group should buy out that group. But Judge Mahler cited numerous other pieces of evidence and information in support of her conclusion that it should be the respondents that would ultimately buy out the appellants. Part of that was the appellant's behavior in bringing WFI into this kind of disastrous financial condition and their repeated comments that they would simply continue filing these lawsuits until things were rectified, at least as far as they were concerned. So I don't think it's fair to say that Judge Mahler based her decision in terms of which group of shareholders would be bought out entirely, exclusively, or even primarily on what Richard Ward testified to at trial. There was significant other evidence in the record that supported that conclusion.
Even if it were true, wouldn't that require us to reweigh the evidence and decide and to stand in the shoes of the district court and making, if it is, as you've argued, a finding of fact, and engaging in fact finding on appeal?
I agree entirely, Your Honor. I mean, that th there was significant evidence in front of Judge Mahler that supported her decision in terms of which shareholders were going to be bought out, even if we take Richard Ward's testimony and we completely excise it from the record. There was also significant reasonable evidence in the record that supported her conclusion on share valuation. And Judge Riley, you touched on this earlier in your questioning of Ms. Jewell, but Robert Strakota was appellant's expert in this case. And I'll say that again. He's appellant's expert in this case, and he testified at trial that appellant shares were worth $1.05 each. And in his testimony, he explained how he came to this valuation. He said that to value WFI, you had to use an asset-based approach, which is the same approach that our expert Jerry Bremer employed. And that asset-based approach takes the value of the company's assets minus the value of the company's liabilities. And then you end up with an ultimate, here's what the company is worth. So WFI's primary asset is 1,200 acres of real property. And Mr. Strakota testified that he appraised it and valued it, valued that property at $1.285 million because of the lease. He then takes the company's current liabilities, which are roughly $240,000, and deducts that out and says, okay, well, WFI has a value using this asset-based approach of $1,055,000. There are 1 million shares in WFI. So if we take $1,055,000 divided by those 1 million shares, we get $1.05 per share. He explained how he came up with the calculation. Judge Mahler ultimately said, you know, I think that's the best way to value each share in the company. And so she adopted it. Took that number times the number of shares that appellants have and said that's what they're entitled to for purposes of their shares in WFI. In there, so I don't think we need to go any further than that to say there is reasonable evidence in the record that supports her ultimate conclusion as to what the value of each share was. But even if we want to go beyond that, I mean, appellants make this argument that the district court shouldn't have considered the lease in valuing WFI's property. But Judge Riley, as you pointed out earlier, appellants have already litigated the validity of that lease in two prior lawsuits. Both of those cases, in both of those cases, the district court found that the lease was in WFI's best interest and upheld it. And when both of those cases went up on appeal, this court affirmed the district court's decision. So they don't get a third bite at the apple now to say, well, the district court shouldn't have considered that lease. Mr. Strakota and Brian Guggenberger, who was our real estate appraiser, also testified at trial that the lease devalued the property and that to get an accurate current value of what the property was worth and what the company was worth, the appraisal had to reflect the lease. So there was more than enough evidence that supported Judge Mahler's decision to consider that lease in valuing the shares in WFI.
I was just going to say, you can understand appellant's frustration that this property, which is valued by everyone at over $10 million because of it being encumbered with this lease, is now valued at a tenth of that, essentially.
Sure. But at the same time, did you have something in follow-up, Judge?
Not with regard to that. I want to talk about attorney's fees in a bit.
Okay. I can certainly understand the frustration, but what I would point you to is the extensive testimony that's in the record about what the intent here is. And the intent is explained by respondents at the trial numerous times. Nobody on my side of the aisle views this thing as some sort of investment fund or is some sort of retirement fund for their future. When they got this property, when all these kids got this property, the plan was that they were going to have their own private state park that they owned free and clear of all debt, that was going to be unencumbered, that was going to be undeveloped, and was going to be a great place for them and their families to enjoy into the future. And what my folks have repeatedly said throughout the course of this case is that they have no intention of selling the property. They have no intention of changing anything. That they have no intention of, you know, now that appellants are out, saying, okay, well, ERM, you get off the property and we're going to sell this thing and make a killing here. This was never viewed as that. And so I think it's more than fair under those circumstances to say, here's how we're valuing the property, especially when the respondents in this case gave the appellants every single opportunity to say, you're going to be involved in this. You're going to have an opportunity to be here. And they consistently and repetitively continued to file these lawsuits that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to the company until finally the shareholders of the company said, or my folks said, no mas. We simply can't continue to incur this debt. Judge Riley, did you say you had a question about attorney's fees?
So with regard to the $3,572.50 in the attorney's fees for the motion to dismiss, I didn't see that that was ever mentioned in your brief and closing arguments. You noted that you had incurred $3,215 in attorney's fees related to the motion to compel, but you didn't say how much you had incurred with regard to the motion to dismiss, except I think in the proposed order. And so I don't see that there's record support for that award.
I did not look at the, I probably should have, but I did not look, Your Honor, at our brief and our closing argument in advance of the, in advance of the hearing today. But I do recall generally that it was mentioned in the proposed findings of fact, but it may not have been mentioned in the closing brief.
So what should happen?
I think the court can take the this court can take the proposed findings of fact that we submitted as part of that closing argument and say that's the evidentiary basis that the district court based its decision on. Now, if the court thinks that there needs to be a more adequate evidentiary basis to allow that award, then I suppose it could remand and it could ask the district court to determine what the appropriate sanction was for that motion for sanctions, and we could certainly submit the appropriate supporting documentation. I suppose the next step to go to is to talk about a couple of things in the reply brief that I noticed as I was preparing for the hearing today. One of the things I wanted to mention is in the reply brief, as it relates to valuation of the shares, the appellants have argued that the district court improperly considered a lack of marketability in determining share value. And I think it's important to note, first off, that's something that the district court could have considered. That's the Advanced Communication Design versus Follett case, which is 615 Northwest 2nd 285. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from the year 2000. But it's also important to point out that the district court in this case did not, in fact, consider that. The district court adopted Mr. Strakota's opinion on share valuation, and his opinion very clearly did not reflect a discount for marketability. He was asked several questions about marketability at pages 475 to 476 of the transcript, and again at pages 486 to 487 of the trial transcript. And at 486 to 487, he specifically disavowed any reliance on a marketability discount in determining the share value for WFI. The other thing I noticed in the reply as I was preparing today was that the appellants repeatedly note that the district court should have allocated fault. One example of this appears at page 12 of the brief, which I think is mislabeled as page 14 of their reply brief. And I'm not quite sure that I understand that comment. This wasn't a negligence case. We weren't there trying to figure out, and we certainly weren't there at the trial trying to figure out who was at fault or responsible for this. The sole focus of the trial was what group of shareholders should be bought out and what the price of the buyout should be. With that, if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we just ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Seeing no other questions, let's turn back to Ms. Jewell for her rebuttal. Oh, and ma'am, you're muted, I think, if you started talking.
I just said thank you, Judge Edie. So I apologize for the lack of the audio being turned on, but you didn't miss much. I really would like to point the court to page 10 of our reply brief. Respondents are misconstruing and misstating our arguments because I guess that's more favorable to them. But on page 10, towards the bottom of the page, I'd like to highlight the fact that we're not questioning the methodology of our expert witness. I don't think any seasoned attorney would attempt to do that upon appeal. We know what Mr. Strakota testified to. We know the Shanahan Company is a very well-reputed company in the state for both, you know, business valuations as well as appraisals. So we're not attempting to unravel the quite expensive report that we got from him. What we're saying, and which we believe is in line and in harmony with his report, is that because of the lease, which I don't think that this court can, you know, totally ignore that. I mean, it was a consideration that both sides had to take as it pertains to 302A.751. And the value.
Can I ask you a question though about that, like just more fundamentally on our appellate review? If the determination of the share value is a finding of fact, as your colleague on the other side has argued, are you in fact asking us to reweigh the evidence? And if so, how do we do that instead of just looking to see if there's reasonable support in the record for the share value that the district court adopted?
Well, I understand this court is really an error correcting court, and it's not, you know, within the purview of this court to, you know, try to refine facts or restate facts as they were found. However, the error that I think, and I hope I'm answering the question correctly, but the error that I think this court needs to look at is the fact that the district court did have the evidence through the testimony of our clients through or the appellants and through Mr. Strakota's testimony that This is not an arm's length transaction with regard to the lease. You have to remember, these are family members. And unfortunately, sometimes family members don't treat each other very respectfully, and they don't treat each other in an honest and fair manner, which is required under 302A. That's one of the, under even subsection 751. You know, there is a duty that is owed between the shareholders to act fairly and honestly. And I think that a deeper look needed to be had in regards to, you know, let's really think about who's controlling this company. It is the respondents. They're the ones controlling it. My clients are finding themselves on, you know, the short end of the stick when it comes to votes. So when they're questioning how the management is working, why would the management do this lease? It benefits Kevin Ward. And that's why I was citing to page 10 of our reply that the court, you know, could have looked into that and said, look, Strakota is saying this is not a normal situation, folks. It devalues, and respondents' argument today admits that, it devalues the shares in an unnatural, non-market value manner. Who does that benefit? It benefits Kevin Ward. He's the one that runs El Rancho Manana, which is the beneficiary of the lease. The ones that are in control of Ward Family Inc. are the ones who decided to put forth that lease over the entire 1,206 acres instead of just the 200 acres that actually encompasses the campground. Why would they do that? Because it helps them on taxes. It devalues the entire 1,200 acres for tax purposes, because the whole thing is wrapped up in a lease that is a non-market value lease. Just, and Strakota had that in his report as well. He said, look, you know, the fact that Kevin Ward through his campground is paying for the taxes, is paying for, actually they have it listed as Green Acres, but I don't know that that's really accurate when there's a commercial campground running on it. You know, they've got all these things lined up to assist Kevin in his campground business. I understand, notwithstanding the prior two cases, but this is new evidence and information that came forth. That's even why we got a seat at the table before Judge Mahler. We had to sue, or request, I should say, under data practices, all the information and evidence from Stearns County Environmental Services to say this campground's been out of compliance for more than a decade with regard to septics, with regard to deck permits, with regard to many issues that were never told to these appellants. We wanted the opportunity to bring those witnesses forward, and furthermore, dive into that further with our motion to compel discovery. We were cut off at a very early stage in this litigation from getting that information, because I don't know if the court does not want to, you know, perhaps unwind some prior decisions that were made because they didn't have all of that information. It was kept hidden. We got.
I need to yeah. interrupt for 1 second, just because our clock seems to be fuzzing in and out, but the time has run out, and I want to give you an opportunity to sum up because I'm not seeing any other questions from the panel.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. So we do ask that the court reverse and remand this matter back to the district court and allow us to have the procedural due process that we are requesting and all the relief that's been requested in our appeal. Thank you.
Thank you to both. Both counsel, excuse me, for your helpful arguments today. The matter is deemed submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.